not a terminal, irreversible decision. It's something that you can reverse any time with some cell interactions. In this case, we're assuming that nothing else happens. The cell just divides. So there's no new interactions. But the extreme case I'm talking about is the cell signal is someone comes in and changes three genes. That's the signal. However it happens, there may not be any biological way for one of my cells to inadvertently go, I think I'll be a baby, and turn those three cells on. But if they were to by accident, what would happen? Well, they would start to divide. They'd start to see blood. They'd start to send off all kinds of signals. They'd start to tell other signals what to do, and so forth. And many people believe that the hallmark of cancer is this idea of cells not remembering what they're supposed to be. They may suddenly decide they're the most important stem cell ever and start crowding everybody else out. They may decide that they're babies. They may decide that they're some horrible, terrible killer cell that you would never want in your body. They may decide they want to be a new type of cell that never existed normally. But the idea is they're not playing by the rules. They're not following what their cells inside, sorry, what the genes inside are telling them to be. So when we forget something like our keys, we wander around looking for them, trying to reconstruct where to put them. When a cell forgets what it is, it's got a lot of choices. One is to sort of guess and hope for the best. Two is to kill yourself. I don't know what I'm supposed to be. I've kind of forgotten what I'm going to do. And that's the most common outcome. But a third time is to become a type of cell that's immortal and divides rapidly and causes cancer. Any other questions?
Yes. According to this plural potency, once you introduce some transcription factors and you already have a program going, like if you're a differentiated cell, you're a skin cell, per se, how does the cocktail of transcription factors that you bring into up 3-4 and all that stuff, how does that overwrite the program, the memory that you already have?
Right. So if you're going to have a memory, a new memory, you got to erase the other one. This is sort of the general idea. And the mechanism is just this one. It's just that this gene product has the ability of clamping this one down. Really, these little green balls go on here and bind and prevent that thing from being made. Now, as you can guess, it's a little more complicated than that because protein B is still there, the purple protein, the blue protein, whatever, still floating around. It doesn't suddenly go around and kill everyone. So this can take some time. It's a wait for all those guys to stop being there too. So for a while, it'll have some conflict. If the cell is trying to become a baby, and yet it's got all kinds of old man stuff sort of floating around. But if you're patient, the idea is, and you simply turn the crank of transcription, all the mRNAs will eventually fade away and be degraded. They're all degraded at some rate. All the proteins are being degraded at some rate. And so simply the normal decay of memories is the reason that the old memory will be erased. It isn't there in the other form. Does that make sense? Now, this gets into the subtleties of it all. Well, normally if you're trying to be gene, you know, cell type B, this thing should turn itself back on. So now how do you, who's going to win? And it's just basic biochemistry. It all depends who binds more strongly to that thing. And this is my big frustration. If people don't tie things like this into biochemistry, you know, literally binding kinetics like we talked about with dorsal ventral, you miss the whole damn thing. It isn't that complicated. It isn't some mysterious thing. It's just certain things bind to some other things. And locks and keys don't really work. My big problem with the lock and key analogy is you either fit in the key and turn the lock, you don't. You don't have keys that kind of open locks. Either open or they don't. They're digital. And that's the big difference. These things have relative binding affinities. Those relative binding affinities control both the speed and effect, you know, efficacy of binding. And that's going to be what's going to determine who wins.
So when Dolly, she was 5, she showed symptoms of an 11-year-old. So she had like arthritis. So is that because like she was cloned from a 6-year-old and that added up or something?
So the short answer is they don't know. You know, we're having a hard time figuring out what worms are doing, let alone what sheep are doing in humans. So we don't know. The suspicion is what you described is that the animal got old DNA. Now, what does that mean, old DNA? I mean, this is a molecule you keep for your entire life. Right? So there are cells in my brain that are old. They got created, and they're still holding that one piece of DNA. That one molecule has been sitting there since before the day I was born, just sitting there. And it's apparently perfectly fine. Now, it actually hasn't been sitting there without changing. It has been hit by all kinds of cosmic radiations and every terrible toxin I've exposed myself to or whatever else. So it is possible that the DNA itself is just mutated in some screwy way. So you just gave it a bad copy. But you were trying to make it an exact copy of that cell. You made a whole animal that was a copy of that cell. Now that's a problem. If you want to pick one of my skin cells, they've all got 99.9999% of my DNA. But what if one of them's got an extra boogered up gene? It might not screw up being a skin cell, right? So what? I'm missing the testosterone receptor or, you know, whatever. Bone morphine and protein 4, don't need it anyway. But if you go and make a whole baby from it, you're missing some stuff. So one possibility is you just ended up with a mutated version of that little piece. The other possibility, that's a more broadly conceived notion, is the DNA have these tails on the end, frame, right? You may know there's little snakelets at the end of your shoestrings to keep it from all unraveling, and there's a thing called a telomere, so you have these long pieces of DNA, and what happens at the ends? And the idea is, well, you just duplicate a bunch of stuff at the ends, and these things have special structures, namely they've got special sequences of G's, A's, and T's, and C's. And what they allow you to do is add more on here to keep growing in case the ends start to tatter and you lose half of it, you can sort of grow it back, like a lizard regrowing its tail. And you can add proteins that actually bind to these things to help keep them from unraveling. So one hypothesis has been that aging is simply a problem with your telomeres. And that's all that there is. It seems like, well, all you would need then is to add more lengthen all the telomeres and all the cells in your body, and you'd be all better. Why would cells have telomeres that weren't already long? It was just that easy. If you just added long telomeres, you'd be healthier. Wouldn't have evolution come up with that? And if it's so simple to cut this off and add it back on, why not just add more on? So the hypothesis is way, way, way too simple. Very unlikely to work, but there were recent big prizes awarded for understanding how telomeres work. Even though it's still not entirely clear, it does have a big role in why some types of cells can divide an infinite number of times, and sometimes divide 8, 10, 40 times and just crap out, and they can't make any more babies at the same time. Other questions? Right. So we've gone through the broad notion about what makes a cell a cell. And I gave you this number before, I don't really know a number, but let's just say that biology is right. When they give you a big theory, 80 to 90% of the time, you'd never think it's 99.9%. But most of these theories really are true. I mean, 90% right is pretty good. And that's what I would put for this one. The protein product is where the memory is. That's 90% true. Individual cells know whether they're boys or girls. They know this for a lot of reasons. One way is they know it because they have the Y chromosome or they don't. So that obviously has nothing to do with the proteins. And being a boy or a girl isn't actually a cell fate. Like, cells don't suddenly decide, I think it'll be, you know, a boy's skin cell versus a girl's skin cell. But there's another aspect of gene regulation that's a little bit more complicated, and that is the problem with having two X chromosomes. So males only have one, females have two, and different species do it wildly different ways. But the problem is they're different, and you actually don't want them to be different. Males and females are not terribly different, as we'll see when we get to them. And it's important that you not have all of the genes in the X chromosome be expressed at half the normal level in males, or they'd be in deep trouble. So males and females express the same amount of protein off of the X chromosome, even though females have twice as many. And in some species, the males produce a lot more off of each X chromosome that they have to compensate. It's called dosage compensation. In other species, such as ourselves, we just throw away one of the X chromosomes if you're a female. So that's actually how we do it. There's a way to look at cells under a microscope and see whether male or female by looking for the presence of this thing called a bar body. And one of these little Nurbert guys in the nucleus here. And what it really is it's a compressed form of one of the chromosomes, the X chromosome. And it's picked at random. It could be your dad's chromosome, X chromosome, or mom's chromosome got inactivated. And it's done in a relatively late stage, not in the first embryo, so it's done in the 40 or 50 cell stage. So you can actually have different cells in your body, some of which are 100% your father's X chromosome, and some of which are 100% of your mother's X chromosome. And this doesn't happen in males. We don't do this sort of thing. You see this most elegantly in the calico cat, where you have these females that have these big blood patches. You can count the patches and figure out what cell stage they turn off one of the copies of the X chromosome if they're having it. So here we've got an example where the DNA structure, now it's a little complicated because the structure is partly based on the DNA, so the proteins that are binding to it, but they're also largely due to changes in the DNA structure itself, folding in particular. The other example is more extreme and more disturbing, so we'll spend a few moments on it. It's this idea that all the DNA in your body is not actually the same. As I remember in class, you heard every cell in your body has got a copy of the DNA. All the DNA in your body is the same. All the twins have the same DNA, and no difference. If you take a strand of DNA out of my twin, and my other twins are going to be exactly the same, or one skin cell the next, or my brain cells and my arm cells. And it'd be nice if it was true, and it is largely true. In biology, we're okay with it being largely true. 80-90%, that's right. But we do want to pay attention to the 10% where it's wrong, because we'd like to be right and not just sort of mostly right. So the exception to this rule, where DNA is the same in every cell, is the presence of these methyl groups on the DNA. So there's another genetic code, and it's actually on the DNA itself, but it isn't the sequence of G's, A's, and T's, and C's. And it's not faithfully passed on from generation to generation. It is mostly faithfully passed on from generation to generation. This is really spooky stuff. People have talked about past life regression and all this stuff. I feel like I know something my mom knew, blah, blah, blah. How could it be that the experiences of an individual would change their genetics? Right? There's an old theory you guys may know from Darwin's time. The reason that giraffes got long necks is because they kept stretching their necks. And they would pass that trait on. You work out more and your children will have bigger muscles. That could have been true. It just mostly isn't true. And the reason is all they get is your DNA and after they say we've got to start from them. This is the one exception where it is true. Where the genes that your mother and father turned on will be different depending upon how they use them. If there were genes that your mom and dad never used, they may be turned off entirely in you. You have them, you have the same genes and diseases as everybody else. But if literally your mom never used it, it may have developed this methylation group. Here's how the methylation group works. You know about the G's, A's, and T's, and C's. Every time you've got a C and a G next to each other, it's possible to put one of these methyl groups on the system. And so, okay, some fraction of G's and C's are methylated, and some are not. We'll get into why they are this way. Most are not, but it's worth. When you duplicate your strand, you build it from normal nucleotides floating in the cytoplasm. You put the G's, A's, and T's back, and they're, so to speak, naked. They don't have these methyl groups on. And there's an enzyme that comes along, its sole purpose in life is to slide around looking for places where there's a methyl group on one side and not on the other. And every time there's a G and a C, there must be a G and a C on the other side, too. And all this thing wants to do is say, every time I find this C next to a G, I want to add a methyl group onto it like that. What's cool about this protein is, if it sees a C and a G without anything on it, it doesn't have one. So the place in the early division, cell division, that had no marking still doesn't. And the one that had a marking now had that be copied. So this is a new trait, sort of a fifth beetle. In addition to all these other flavors, your four bases, G's, A's, and T's, and C's, you now get the other C or the other CG pair kind of thing. A little bit more information. And that would be neat if there was more bits of information, right? Take 3 billion base pairs, you multiply it by four different combinations, right? And you think about how many combinations would there be? If I had one base, there's four possibilities. If I had two, there's 16. So it's just four to the number of base pairs combination. Four to 3 billion is a pretty damn big number. I think most people will grant you that that's a lot of possible animals you could have made. That now becomes a little bit bigger if you have this choice. Not quite 5 to 3 billion, but it's still huge, and it seems neat. Now, why screw up this whole thing to only squeeze out a little bit more combinations when there's so damn many accommodations you couldn't possibly give them? And the answer is that's not what this is really for. This is not to just pack more information onto the human genome. This is to allow you to pass on to your offspring, even if you never see them. Right? Lots of animals pass on to their offspring only their genes and never raise them. Think about frogs or fish dispersing in the world. It sure would be nice to say, hey, in my lifetime, it was really helpful to be afraid of bats. It would be really helpful to be, you know, stay low in the water column. Whatever it might be, it'd be really helpful. Now, complex memories are hard. What if it was something simple? What if it was just, in my experience, you should turn this gene on? Trust me, you're going to need this gene. And the best studied are things like environmental toxins. There are some animals who, most animals, have toxin response genes that help to clear heavy metal and other carcinogens from the system. They always had negative consequences, otherwise you'd always have them. So you don't want it on if you don't need it, and you want it on if you do. Well, how are you supposed to know if you're going to need it? By the time you need it, you should have already had it on. And it may cycle on a generational time. So this is the kind of example people have studied. If you expose mice and rats to certain toxins, you can then look at the possibility of their offspring being sensitive to that toxin, doing all kinds of beautiful controls, find out that it's often the methylation of certain genes that are methylated, differentially methylated, that allow them to be differentially expressed. So how does this work? We first thought it would be really simple and elegant, beautiful, and I can explain it in 2 minutes. It turns out it's not simple, so I can only give you a thumbnail sketch. But let's just imagine the way it was first conceived. If this gene is very often made and used, whatever protein is right here, billions of the base pairs, but whatever this little section is, if it's used all the time, the consequence of it being used all the time is going to be proteins here all the time, right? Proteins bound to it like we talked about in the fly. And if they're bound here, it's not going to be possible for that replacement enzyme to get in here. It's going to be a little bit less likely that that replacement enzyme is going to be there. So it's more likely that I would make it through an entire round of cell division without ever getting that thing replaced. And if it was, I would now make a daughter that didn't have these on either ends. And once it doesn't have it, it will continue to not have it forever. Does that make sense? The general notion is you can learn how often is this gene being transcribed, how often are the proteins bound to it, and that will be reflected in how much methylation there is. If, and this is a big if methylation modulates how quickly cells are transcribed, then the past need for this gene will increase the future need for this gene. Where you got that part? There's a whole new way for genetics to work, not with natural selection, you have to live or die, but having a memory in the embryo, in the DNA, in the nucleus itself, in the chemical form of where are these methylators, as a marker of how much did my mom need this gene or how much did my dad need this gene. That's going to give you a big leg up on the competition, who's got to figure it out in real time, especially if the environment is changing quickly, as it often does. Any questions about that? Yes?
So depending on where the methyl group is, you make different proteins?
Good question. Okay. So this is not really the fifth beetle. It's not an extra version. We're still going to have the same thing. A, G, C is still going to make whatever amino acid it makes. It's not going to change the protein at all. Okay? So none of this stuff has anything to do with changing the proteins. We're about changing the amount of protein. So normally if I've got the RNA polymerase sliding along and all these promoters and enhancers being bound, turning on, and this says I should make 90 units of this per hour. If it's methylated, maybe I only make 50 units. And maybe 50 units is not enough to turn it around and turn it over. There's a lot of nonlinearities, and maybe it eventually crashes to zero. If it's one of these things where you need a certain amount to turn yourself on, 50 may not be enough, in which case now the whole gene may get shut off or whatever. So you can imagine how complicated it could be. So it's a little bit of hand-waving. We just don't know exactly how this is used. But the idea is it's a whole new toolbox. It's not in the high school biology book, may not be in the college biology book for all I know. Yeah?
Is there a way to So methylation always decreases the transcription of the...
That's what I was just going to get back to. Nope, that'd be nice. Wouldn't that be nice if it was just like one simple rule? No, and not only does methylation not always do the same thing, but active genes sometimes accumulate more methyl groups and sometimes less. So here's the trick. There's two things going on. It's like it's just pissing you off. Like it's as complicated as it could possibly be. I'll see if I can explain why. So I mentioned this idea that the DNA strand is sort of crowded. So this one little area, there's just so much stuff going on that this they can't ever bind it, you can never put the little methyl group back on it. And so you can lose the memory of the methyl group there, right? Already got that part? The problem is DNA is not just regulated locally, it's also regulated globally. So a very important part of DNA is how the whole thing is folded. So one of the ways that enhancers and promoters activate genes is they'll literally unfold the DNA in a particular region. They'll put a kink in it, I'll show you a little picture, like this. They'll actually fold the DNA over, and that kink will mean it won't lay as nicely as all the rest of the pasta. It'll open up a little pocket, and it'll make it easier for molecules to get in, including the molecule that's maintaining the methylation. And sometimes that molecule inadvertently adds a methyl group in a site it shouldn't. It does make mistakes. So again, now it's locally regulated and globally regulated. Now having an extra methyl group usually means you make less, but not always. And you think, how on earth could this system possibly work if these signals don't mean any one thing? And the answer is, they do mean one thing. The problem is they mean one thing to each protein, right? So remember, there's 35,000 proteins. The vast majority do not bind to DNA. But if there's only 1,000 proteins that bind to DNA, that's a conservative number. Let's say it's way more than that. But let's say there's 1,000. Each one of them has its own binding constant. Remember, this whole thing is important about biochemistry. But all that stuff is almost useless, except understanding how things bind is really important. It's not really lock and key. It's not about anything else. It's about speed and binding. If there's 1,000 different genes, they are the ones that are interpreting this signal. Does that make sense? They are the ones that are deciding, do I bind better when there's a methyl group there, or do I bind less well? And some proteins could bind better when it's methylated, and some would bind less well. Well, good God, is this going to be confusing for us? The question is it confusing to biology? No, it just does what it does. It doesn't have to consider itself. It doesn't have to understand itself. It just has to follow the rules of natural selection. And systems that work well, and methylation is one of them, get selected for. They give you a new power that the other animals didn't have. It seems goofy and messy, so screwing up everything. But it's increasing diversity. Even if it just added noise, it might not be bad. But if it's increasing diversity and allows you to send information down the generations rapidly without losing proteins, only changing subtly how much of each protein you make, that would be really, really helpful. And biology invented that on accident and promulgates it, but never made it simple. Other questions?
Is this called epigenetics?
Yes. This is one of the examples of epigenetics that's best understood. And they called it a field because they said, maybe this isn't all there is, maybe there's 10 other mechanisms we don't know about yet. And it wouldn't shock me if there were 4, 5, or 10 other mechanisms. My brother, for what it's worth, I think I mentioned this to you, is absolutely convinced that this is wrong. That 3 billion base pairs is just not enough. And his rationale for that is, it fits on my thumb drive. There's no way in hell I fit on my own thumb drive. That just can't be. It's disturbing to him as a computer science major. And he finds it just distasteful that his own blueprint could be so simple. There's no way you guys are missing something. Well, how many base pairs do you need? I don't know, more than 3 billion. You know, if the computers get bigger and a terabyte is suddenly 1,000 terabytes, okay. If we found a molecule that had thousands of terabytes, would you be comfortable? Yeah, that'd be good. So it's not really logically based necessarily, but it's not a stupid argument because he's just saying, let's imagine that biology probably doesn't know the answer. And that's not a terrible position to take. As biology majors, you should not take that position because it'll mean you've studied the wrong thing and it's useless. I think it's probably not right. There are certainly other things, small nuclear binding proteins and these little RNAs and all these little variations, methylation. There'll be 4 or 5 more, but it isn't making the 3 billion base pairs any less important. all of the sequences, as far as we know, all of the sequences of the proteins are built in here. And someone says, well, wait a minute. But then you get transplicing, like the sequence doesn't tell you what it's going to be. Yeah, but that is determined by the proteins too. And so I think it is 99% true that the DNA does tell you what the sequences of the amino acids are. Other questions? Yes?
How many generations can the methylation have? Can it keep going? And so if my kids have kids who have kids, will it still be there?
Sometimes it does, yes. So I think in the mice studies, it's two generations that they'll often look. And if that gets smaller, and there's just noise and things are coming up. Mice genetics takes a long time to do mouse genetics, you have to breed them. So in flies, my guess is they'll find a statistically significant effect of five generations. You can do this very easier, repeat it a zillion times, but it's going to be an effect size of like 0.01% more. What does that mean? So it's not just how long does it last, how long can you detect it, but how long is it sort of meaningful? So, you know, if my hair is 1/1,000,000% longer, I've been doing good, something meaningful. So I would say if people have measured what we would consider as neuroscientists and certainly psychologists, is there a behavioral change, for example? You can measure behavioral changes. Changes in anxiety, for example, can be measured two generations later, which is sort of amazing. People literally thought that when the embryo went out, it was a total clear slate, end of story. If it's broken, that's one thing, but there wouldn't be actual inheritance of signals that were individual experiences like trauma and nutrition. Malnutrition can do these sorts of things. Toxin exposure, those are the big three that people study. Other questions? So I just want to try to come to some consensus on what we've really learned here. What we've really learned is the bit of the DNA that's making the amino acid sequences, those are not the important bits. That's not the part to worry about. We have basically the same genes that we had a billion years ago. There aren't really any new genes that we can find that are really exciting. But tweaking subtly with all the rest of the base pairs, billions and billions of base pairs, when each gene gets turned on and so forth, that is really the exciting bit. So the part that you want to pay attention to is not the gene, by which most people mean, wrongly, the coding region that leads to the messenger RNA and leads to the protein. You guys may know that many people have called all the rest of this stuff chunk DNA. That was a big, big, big debate just a few years ago. We were going to sequence the human genome. Should we sequence the chunk? It's got to be so much easier if we just not sequence that part, right? If we could just sequence the 35,000 times a couple hundred bases that we need, or a couple kilobases that we need, that'd be a lot easier than sequencing all 3 billion base pairs. And people finally said, let's just know it all. We're not paying it, and the taxpayers are paying for it anyway. Let's not solve this anytime soon. They thought it would take decades, and they're going to be a lot faster than that. Now it looks like there's a $1,000 genome pretty soon, and the hope is it'll be down to $10 in the not too distant future. It's been dropping by a factor of 2 every 2 years, which is, there aren't very many things on the consumer side that drop by a factor of 2 every few years. But the rate of sequencing a kilobyte of DNA has been dropping at that rate, which is why you see it on CSI and all this. Okay, so here's the idea. Just, I think you guys get this part, but I want to make a picture and really show this. Why a particular protein gets turned on in a particular area is because of the control region. The control region here is shown small. It's usually the exact opposite of this. It's not the small part that's the control region, it's the big part that's the control region. And it's the coding region that's small, and it's not just on one side, like in front of it, it's on both sides of it. So the coding region is usually thousands of base pairs, and coding region is usually hundreds of amino acids long, so 1,000, let's say, base pairs long, and the non-coding region can be tens of kilobases, in some cases, a megabase. So here we're just showing this by saying, let's take a particular gene that we want to study, human growth hormone, and putting it using the promoter, the control region from something else, elastase that will cause it to be produced in a particular place in the pancreas of the mouse, and attach that control region to this gene and stick it in the virus or whatever else, and suddenly you're going to see that protein just gets produced. So nobody usually, it's not always true, but nobody really knows what the protein is, because usually the protein does not come back and cycles around itself. We talked about exceptions where it does, but mostly if you have a correct control region that says, if you are wings, make this protein. They don't know what it is. I'm a wing, I'll make the protein. They don't really think about it at all. as I showed before, how this all works is worthy of knowing. It's just outside the scope of this class. Knowing about all the details, it's going to end up being binding concepts. If that part, if you missed that part of biochemistry, or God forbid you haven't had biochemistry yet, pay attention when they talk about binding constants. That's the cool part. And it seems really boring, and it's hard to appreciate that it's a miracle enough to stagger 6 billion infidels, that a few binding constants could do something. But they do. They generate an enormous amount of important information. So here's RNA polymerase sliding along, and all kinds of transcription factors. Some are activating, some are repressing it, and so forth. Many times we see signals that are simple. You have some ligand A activating some receptor B and turning on some signal C. Sometimes they're even simpler, as in this case, where you don't need anybody else. You just have this hormone, steroid hormone, directly bind to the receptor already inside. So you don't have to go through this extra step and directly move to the nucleus and bind to and turn on different genes of interest. Other cases, more typically, what we'll see are things like this: some signal activates another signal, activates another signal, activates another signal, activates another signal. And this is really silly. Some of these things are called, you know, microtubule-associated protein kinase, right? Okay, that's a good name. That's a kinase that's associated with microtubules. But then there's a kinase that activates it. So we call that microtubule-associated protein kinase kinase. And that protein, in turn, is also activated by a kinase. And so there's a gene called microtubule-associated protein kinase kinase kinase. Now, that seems a little silly, but that's how it works. And my kids think great-great-grandmother is sort of a joke. But it's true. We call them great-great-grandmother. And you keep going on and on and on. So it's not that complicated. But this is sort of surprising to do this. Like, what is the purpose here? Why wouldn't evolution just found a way to make a gene that would still do this? And you see so many examples where it does. You have to remember in your head this ringing sound I told you before. When things get complicated, there's a reason. Evolution has lots of selective pressure against making things unnecessarily complicated. So there's probably some useful bit. And when there's more than one chain like this, it's usually because there's some factor H that you just didn't happen to know about. And it's doing something really critical that you're unaware of because you want to study. You can't see things you don't study. Other examples are shown here. These are two immediate early genes, June and FOS. And they can do cool things like bind to each other and have interaction. Just the beginning of normally we've been saying single genes doing multiple things. Again, I've mentioned it before, which you can have A and B work together to activate C, or you get no activation of C by A or B alone. All this idea of examples of molecular computation. Okay, so we're mostly through the sections on how to make a cell generally, and we're now ready for our last little mad dash through making neurons specific. And there's not going to be anything really exciting. The same things, methylation is going to matter, and gene expression patterns, and hormones are going to matter. Everything that matters, everything else, is going to matter for genes as well. We look for some types of cells to study that are going to be amenable because neurons are just so damn complicated. This set of cells that come from the neural crest we talked about are advantageous for the reasons we already discussed. They have this trait of coming from a known place and being somewhat homogeneous, not so much. And then suddenly making lots of decisions. Kind of like those blood cells start with a few numbers and suddenly make all these choices. And most importantly, decisions are really, really different. There's zero overlap between, you know, this Schwann cell, this cholinergic parasympathetic neuron, here's cartilage, and here's a melanocyte. What on earth those things have to do? That's obviously not exactly zero, but a relatively little number, at least in terms of the functional final outcome proteins, you really want to do the job. It's hard to see what the melanocyte has in common with the sensory neuron and whatever else. What we're interested in is trying to figure out how do these cells make these decisions. And the long story is going to be the same as they always do. Some combination of I learned it because someone told me to do it, or I remember it that my mother told me I should do this. But those are the choices. We can see nice examples of this. So here's the fate map in the the neurocrest. So what we're doing here is we're just injecting cells in the neurocrest and seeing what they go on to become. Again, don't bother memorizing all the analogs thing. It's not the critical game necessarily. The larger point though is neurocrest cells from the head area, the cell area, they don't go on to make everything. And there's a lot of possible reasons. One possible reason is they aren't everywhere. Like if you're gonna end up in the toenail, you start in the head, it's more likely that neurocrest cell in the back is gonna end down there to make toenails or whatever else it is. So just the fact that you're distant could be it, it's just less likely to get there. But it's also possible that it is impossible. You just have already made a cell lineage decision by virtue of being near the head, you may have decided I'm not gonna become toenails, I'm not gonna become cartilage, I'm not gonna become melanocytes or whatever else it is. So you need another experiment to tease this apart, and that's shown down here. You need to do some transplantation experiments. So simply watching cells didn't do us any good, didn't fly, didn't do us any good anyplace else. You have to go rip them all out, move them all kinds of different places. And that was hard on the fly, it was hard on any animal, but it's particularly hard on the brain. Because these are not young developing embryos, the cells are loosely attached, and you can sort of tweak them apart and shove them someplace else without screwing them up too bad. This is a brain. And you don't generally rip out little pieces and shove it someplace else and have it not just be dead. And that's not a thing we're interested in. So these are hard experiments, but you can do them in the neurocrest cells. And the long story short is, it's a genetic combination of cell lineage and cell fate. If you move these guys to a new place, the vast majority of cells can make all the different fates. But some can't. Right? So these guys have already been exposed to some factor that says, they're not able to make this type of tissue. Cells over here, when you transplant them here, don't have that ability. Okay? So the reason that these cells don't go on to make this type is not because they're not in the right place. You can pick them up and move them there, give them the exact same environment, and they still won't do it. But the majority of cells, these guys, don't normally go on to make pairs of ganglia, but they could if you rip them out and shove them in the right place. Okay? Any questions about this? Okay, I think I'll stop there. Be sure to keep up with the readings. We're going to do the last bit of this section from Kandel on neural genesis, and we'll start talking about axon guidance. We'll spend quite a bit of time on that section, so I think it'll be the most exciting part of this course, or one of the two most exciting parts, so be sure to take that chapter very seriously. It'll be overrepresented on the exam.